And what's interesting is that in the last three years, RECAP and some of these other methods for the city to actually hear from the development community has really made a huge difference, not only in terms of the customer relationships that we have out there, but also in terms of how the development community creates a dialogue with the city. And this has transformed our relationship with you. And Commissioner Leonard, I have to thank you for your push on this. And we're seeing also that this is having an effect elsewhere. So the result of the report has some really key findings. The impact assessment process, unfortunately, was used inconsistently, and we'd like to see that change. A written impact may not actually be revisited as proposed regulations are revised. So in other words, you have an impact, something changes in the code, and then we don't go back and actually see is it actually addressing the needs of the community. Very few comments were made on the reports actually published by Planning, Bureau of Planning, and the Development Services Bureaus. So, again, part of that feedback of how do we actually get the community to respond, which is something Commissioner Fitch just actually was talking about. You know, we have been focused on this literally for the last 2.5 years. How do we get effective communication into the bureaus and out of the bureaus, but also into your offices so that you can actually hear what we're actually saying as well? We also found that it was difficult for others to actually evaluate and interpret the actual thinking that leads to the decision makings around policy. And that was one of the things that, you know, having consistent documentation of the process was somewhat missing. So given that that was the landscape that we found, we needed to find an easy way to actually start a dialogue, not only within the development community, but the neighborhoods as well, because that is where a lot of the concern has come from our policies. So we spent a considerable amount of time thinking through this, and we created what's called the impact assessment game. And it's a very simple way for us to actually start communicating with the general public, but also within the bureaus, about what the concerns have been. Now, in the past, we had an impact assessment flowchart, which is actually fairly complicated. And frankly, I don't even understand it. So, you know, and I'm part of the development community. We needed to simplify that process. And the impact assessment game gave us a handhold for that. And I believe you have an example of that. In fact, we just had two bureaus request the game for policy review just last week. And it's turning out to be a very simple way for people to make sure that they're communicating with you, with the development community and the community at large. And it's become very useful. And again, it's just a tool. It's not a mandate, but it's a way for us to actually see what the landscape's looking like. One example of this is the recent Title 29 discussion, which was basically a review of the code to be able to deal with derelict commercial structures. The building code had absolutely no way to do this. We had derelict housing for neighborhoods and ways to actually deal with and effectively manage derelict housing, but not in the residential realm, but not in the commercial realm. We established a panel to review this. We had great dialogue with your office and also established a way where businesses, residences, and the community could actually get their issues heard. Had great dialogue with the small business community and mitigated a lot of the impacts that could have happened with that Title 29 actually being instituted the way that the city was looking at it. So again, the effort from the city was correct. The implementation just needed to be tweaked to be able to get all the concerns on the table. And it actually became somewhat painless, to be honest, which I'm very happy about. And in 6 weeks, we actually resolved some major issues. So that is one example. Another example is just recently where in the planning of the new MAX trains and some of the other trains that we actually have going on, you know, how are we integrating infrastructure planning with this new transportation planning? You know, on the east side, for instance, and this isn't, you know, we don't know all the information, but we heard from Bureau of Planning and the Bureau, the Water Bureau, that we could have actually put the train tracks on the other side of the street without tearing up all the mains on the east side as a planning idea. And was that reviewed? Was that impact actually seen? And we're seeing a major cost increase just based on the very simple decision on which side of the road to actually put the train line on. So those are the kinds of things we'd like to actually propagate you know, have lots of questions and make sure that impact assessment is on the tip of everyone's tongue, so that when bureaus are actually planning, they're actually looking at what are the inputs and how are the budgets going to be affected from decisions they're making. Thank you.
Can I ask one question on that?
Yeah.
Because something that I think over the years I've heard is that the issue is framed in terms of the Bureau of Planning does the master planning, code gets written, mm-hmm. and then BDS is charged with interpreting and applying code that often is contradictory, ambiguous, or what have you. And so this out of that, which as early as, I guess, 2002, I got an earful, and so did Randy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might have remembered that.
Very 2002. Well. Very well.
We may have been candidates. But the so I really applaud this effort of trying to bring stakeholders together to work through problems yeah. proactively. Yeah. But I'm just curious, in terms of the successor you had, you said Parks, Sustainable Development, Water, BDS, and PDOT are the five yeah. core bureaus. But I don't see Bureau of Planning. I see Bonnie McKnight on DRAC, and
yeah.
she's sort of superwoman. But she's on it, citywide planning from a citizen's point of view. But so how does the Bureau of Planning intersect with what you're doing?
Well, what's interesting is that we have a great dialogue with the Bureau of Planning. I'm actually going to be sitting on the Bureau of Planning's budget committee as well oh. as the BDS's budget committee. And so we actually look at both of those things very carefully. You're right. There are some inconsistencies. We need to solve those. And that's actually part of what the request we're going to be having with the Portland plan and the review of the comprehensive plan is, how do we actually get these bureaus with planning to be able to utilize our infrastructure and our development services as critical economic engines for the city? How do we actually get, you know, that dialogue to establish where not only do we make things work better, but how do we actually leverage it into an economic engine? And that is a critical conversation for the next few years. So
is it fair to say that your perspective is that your focus is on impact, so you're looking at the bureaus that are impacted by those decisions?
Yes.
But you don't need planning as a member of DRAC or in some formal capacity because you have good lines of communication and they're assisting you in this process. They don't have to be part of a stakeholder group.
They are active, actually, on the in the meetings themselves. Even though it's not necessarily listed as a participant, there are three people from planning, and they actually give us reports consistently. So, but you know, it's a little bit of a misnomer that they're not necessarily involved completely because they're actually present at every meeting that we have.
Yep.
And that's actually one of the vital functions of our meetings, is we get direct impact and direct communication from the stakeholder groups that we represent individually to each of the bureau heads and the representatives.
So I was going to address this issue that you brought up about the inconsistencies in some of our planning code that in 2002 created deadlock. And what I discovered was that the employees at the Bureau of Development Services that were charged with enforcing those codes, when they would see inconsistencies, took a very conservative view and would do the most oftentimes restrictive thing in order not to get outside of the box. So one of the significant changes in the approach that we have changed through training is to, and the reason you don't hear this as much as you used to, which is we have to do something about these duplicative codes, we have to do something about these conflicting codes, is the employees now view them as options. And they're options that are then explored with developers, builders, and the community in terms of what's possible in a project. So as opposed to viewing them as conflicting and causing problems, they oftentimes can be used in a variety of ways because no project is alike with another project. I mean, you have different neighborhoods, you have different densities, you have different zonings, you have different appropriate uses. And really, sometimes the code, though it may appear on its face to be conflicting, really affords us some opportunity to be creative in how we apply it so that it fits better into a neighborhood or fits better for the developer. And these guys have helped a lot towards that end as well, having us recognize what options might work better.
That's very helpful. And just on a related note, you know, PDC we think of as the Portland Development Commission as the implementing agency for a lot of this. So planning, send staff people to your DRAC meetings to be a resource? What's your level of interaction with the Portland Development Commission?
From the standpoint where we're actually dealing with policy itself, not very much. But you know, we'd like to have more. We'd like to actually see more implementation, not even and more discourse there. I don't necessarily. I'm not aware of those discussions because those are much. They're above my pay grade, you know. So I don't know necessarily, you know, what those issues are because we're specifically focused with the bureaus and their concerns and the community's concerns right then. The what I'm referring to as an economic sort of development sort of conversation is what we're hoping for. We'd like to have more of. And so to answer your question, yes, we'd like to have more. No, right now we don't have much.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to move along to Green Building, yes?
SDCs,
sorry.
No problem. So Don Geddes with Walsh Construction.
Could you turn that?
I can do that.
Thank you.
Okay. So the next topic that we wanted to talk about is we've recently set up another subcommittee that there was interest in the DRAC to look at, which was how are SDCs evolving? How are they getting set? Is there any oversight to them? So we set up a subcommittee that is currently in process. So you're not going to get a request or a report from us today on that, just an update. And as we go through that, what we're finding is as we sit down with the various, you know, there are really four bureaus that are, or four organizations with SDCs. You've got Parks, Transportation, BES, and Water are the four. And then we also sat down and talked with the Public Utility Review Commission, or Review Board, PURB, and asked what their process was and what their involvement was. And we're finding, you know, there are two types of SDCs really coming out of things. You've got those like BES, which can charge a fee, as can Water. And so they're looking back to pay for improvements as needed. But you have Parks and Transportation, which has really no resource, no income from fees other than SDCs. So they have to do it as, you know, they set up projects that they want to do and then they see what they can fund based on where income comes from the development source. So as we look as a group, we'll be looking to try and figure out, again, from a higher level, is really what we're trying to see is there any coordination between any of these SDC fees? And an example I'd give you would be, if planning, as an example, says we want to do a town center neighborhood in any part of this city, is there any focus to using the SDCs as part of that, or are each of these groups doing their own thing, doing their own projects? And an example would be if we're trying to do a town center, I know as a contractor, we oftentimes in unimproved streets put a piece of sidewalk in. That's part of, you know, coming through transportation that we're being forced. We put a sidewalk in to nowhere. You've got sidewalk in front of your building. It goes absolutely nowhere because the rest of the street is unimproved and probably will remain that way for long periods of time, if not ever. The reality is if two blocks away we're trying to do a neighborhood center that needs new sidewalks, needs new corridors to get people through for pedestrian ways, wouldn't it be better maybe to take that money and charge the developer and contractor that money, but put it into a pot that's better used? And our question is anybody looking at that as a group? And we're not sure they are.
You know, I think I see a campaign issue down the road, the sidewalk to nowhere. You know, Dennis, on the question of the aggregate effect, that's an issue that we up here hear all the time from people, particularly developers. It's a first cousin of what we hear about. Let us know what all the permitting issues are. Make, you know, get clear guidance from fire and from Bureau of Buildings and everyone else is what we do before we do a renovation. But the next thing is not looking at systems development charges as a series of islands.
Yes.
But understanding the aggregate. I love that word, the aggregate effect. That's what we hear consistently from developers wanting to know. And then also wanting to know where, if there's a movement to adjust and increase one during the pre-development phase. Because these pro formas are pretty sensitive.
They are very sensitive and getting more sensitive at the moment.
And as you and I know in the affordable housing arena, these things are getting harder and harder to pencil out. So it's the certainty we're talking about. It's understanding that the aggregate effect is what you're looking at, not being nickel and dime by every single charge. And if you're successful in allowing the customer to see in the aggregate all those charges and to have the folks talking to each other, recognizing that if you increase one over here, it could actually have an unintended effect over here. Yeah. It could be the straw that breaks the camel's back on some other activity you're trying to encourage. That, I think, would be great progress.
And so that's our goal over the next year, is to finish our studies and get back to you in the future with a report similar to the Green Report you're going to hear next.
Nice.
So that's really just a brief update on that. Dennis?
Okay. I want to talk to you briefly about the Green Building report and recommendations, and I believe you all have received this very easy to read tome. And by the way, you'll also be getting a summary of the 22 recommendations that are included, which was, I don't believe, was included in the packet that you got this morning. So that'll be forthcoming. I wanted to start out this morning with one brief anecdotal story that relates to the prior conversation you had about, you know, feedback loop, you know, with the citizenry. There was recently a group of visitors from Regina, Saskatchewan, including the mayor, several commission members, and economic development director, and others, came to Portland, you know, wanting to know, you know, what's the magic sauce in Portland? You know, how have we created, you know, a strong, livable city? And I thought the most important thing they said, you have a beautiful city, you've done remarkable things, but the thing that we find more remarkable than anything else, and what we haven't seen in any other community we visited, is that the public sector and the private sector seem to have the same dialogue going on. You use the same language, you talk about a similar vision. We don't see that anywhere else. And I thought that was a really remarkable testament to the success that we've had as a community. And I think DRAC is, you know, is one example of the efforts of the city to build and maintain that dialogue and that correspondence and to figure out how to continually improve and upgrade the city services. So with that, I'll talk specifically about the Green Building Report. As Commissioner Leonard said, we started in January of 07, spent 10 months developing a series of recommendations. There were six DRAC members on the committee and then a number of representatives from outside of DRAC, including single family home builders, the Home Builders Association, BOMA, other bureaus of the city, and we had broad representation and general consensus, not complete consensus, but general consensus around the recommendations. We developed recommendations in six categories. There's a pie chart that I won't go into a great deal of detail on that, other than we focused on the areas where we felt the city could provide, you know, specific assistance, whether it's education and outreach, financial incentives, regulatory measures, performance certification. I'll talk a little bit about that briefly. Technical assistance, and then benchmarking and assessment tools, monitoring, if you will. In those six categories, we came up with 22 recommendations, and we're going to talk about three just to give you an example what's going on. One is doing a construction codes audit, and there was a technical advisory group which was created and is still ongoing and doing a detailed audit of the building codes and looking at a national demonstration code that was developed by ASHRAE, which is the Association of Heating and Refrigeration Engineers. That's a comprehensive code that attempts to try and take the LEED certification process and see how you could codify it, if it's even possible. And so now, as a city, we're going through that same process and trying to figure out, you know, what could we legitimately include, you know, in our code process so that it more accurately reflects, green building standards. So that's an ongoing activity that was a byproduct of the Green Building Subcommittee. Second one is a green building review committee looking at alternative systems, evaluating non-standard data, and developing then recommendations around products and methods that will allow these technologies to be put in place in the city of Portland. So how do we take innovative ideas and materials and start to anticipate their utilization and by allowing the flexibility within the review process? And then finally, the idea of much like the narrow lot home strategy that the city has successfully adopted, is seeing if there's a way to have pre-approved green plans that could be incorporated, particularly focusing on the single-family residential and small-scale development category. As I mentioned, it wasn't all unanimous. The one recommendation, or a series of three recommendations we made around green building performance evaluation. And there was some controversy about, you know, does the city have the right to mandate energy performance in buildings, much like we do with fire and life safety inspections? A fire marshal goes around and inspects all buildings, you know, once or twice a year. Elevator inspectors come out and inspect elevators. You know, does the city or the public have the same obligation and right in terms of the energy performance of buildings? Should we audit the energy performance and post it, you know, so that it becomes, maybe we don't mandate performance, but certainly we start to elevate the performance of the building so that it becomes a factor in terms of the value, asset value of that property. So it could be at time of sale or periodically have a performance review. Bowman and some others, you know, felt this this might be pushing the notion too far. But I would just offer up that Governor Kulongowski has included some similar ideas in his carbon reduction strategies at the state level, and the new administration in Washington, D.C. is also starting to talk about similar strategies. So this is not an idea that's dead. I think we just have to figure out how do we work with the building owners groups to, you know, to understand their concerns and figure out how to successfully address their concerns and still move the ball forward.
So that brings us to what we want to ask of you. And that is that the green building policy is really a call for a citywide sustainability policy. Doing it piecemeal will not actually work because this impacts all aspects of city process. This gets back to the impact assessment. This is why we brought two of these issues together. Green building does actually incur additional cost. It also incurs additional maintenance fees and all sorts of other things. However, the benefit of that needs to be measured by the community, and we all need to agree that this is the direction we want to go in. One of the things that has come up in the impact assessment was, are there other ways to get things done? We need to have alternatives to regulation necessarily. Now, regulation is very important. It actually protects the public sphere and fire, life, and safety. We definitely are not issuing a mandate against that. But there are maybe other ways for us to actually drive development and to drive innovation within our development community. And we would like to explore ideas with you. We'd like to see different ways to actually get that done. Another aspect that's really critical is that we hear time and time again that we need other tools for economic development. We see the development services community and what you guys do as a city as a viable economic development engine. With the shift in the economy, we are concerned. We did an informal poll of our members, and we are actually seeing a cliff, a literal shutdown of the development community. We are already seeing shortfalls in the development bureaus in terms of what's showing up. And we want to put a warning out there for the next 3 to 6 months, it's going to be dire because a lot of the projects have literally stopped in their tracks. There's no lending going on. We see the next 18 months as being a serious challenge to the development community and to the city, which impacts parks. It impacts all the other aspects that actually get paid for through development fees. So we want to alert you to that fact. Personal experience, my office actually has literally shut down except for maintenance contracts. So there are some real concerns in terms of what's going on in the community at large, in the development community. This is why we see the comprehensive plan as possibly the most innovative, potentially leading a policy agenda that can come up in the next few years.
Talk about the Portland plan.
The Portland plan, the review of the comprehensive plan. It is critical that we start looking at how infrastructure and the other bureaus and economic development can be integrated into an economic development policy that utilizes the development services as not an afterthought, but as a forward-moving entity that is constantly in dialogue with the city. The other aspect is that there's a strategic vision missing when we have the bureaus in different camps. So this is also a request that you as commissioners and the mayor really look at how to integrate policy of these development bureaus so that this economic engine can actually work correctly. We're going to see additional infrastructure spending in the next few years, and this is actually critical that we're actually putting it in the right place. That's why Bureau of Planning and the PDC is critical in terms of what we do in the development community. And the other part is that the cost-benefit analysis has to be done. This impact assessment issue is really going to come home when we actually have reduced spending and reduced development activity. So changes in SDC fees, changes in how the total aggregate cost of development shows up, is something that is on our radar and will be critical in the next few years. So I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for taking a look at our reports. I also want to invite you to our meetings every month. It is open dialogue, and we're always there. I'm available, and many of us are available for dialogue outside of it.
Thank you, Stuart. Nice presentation. Thank all of you. You did really good work.
Do we have folks signed up to testify on this issue?
No one signed up.
Is there
also, just want to acknowledge when they're here, while these guys are here, that this is really a refreshing group of people to work with. I mean, they've used this group as a way to move forward development and standards, and never to block doing the right thing, whether it's increasing fees or increasing standards. And I just want you to know, I'm very cognizant of that, and I cherish that, and I just think that it's really a great example of how we can work well with the private sector. And so you've been just a really great progressive, proactive group.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That's scary, isn't it? We've actually endorsed fee increases.
I know. but greatly appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank
which
you.
Which proves to me, if you give good, smart people all the information, they make 90% of the time the same decisions over and over. And so
Randy,
I really appreciate that.
Can I piggyback off that for a second? Because I learned a lot today, and Kate Allen, who's the housing policy coordinator for the city of Portland, actually over the weekend read this report cover to cover, and I have her marked up copy and her cover memo, and there's just a ton of good stuff here for us. And I, as the person who's in charge of leading the affordable housing community, there's so much stuff here. And one thing I wanted to dispel is that, you know, affordable housing developers, for-profit developers, they all have great concerns in this environment, as you noted, about cost. You're saying there's an enormous decrease in activity and people seeking permits. The tax credit market that upon which we rely to do affordable housing is basically dead. So there's tremendous consequences to this global economic crisis that's affecting us at home. But what's encouraging to me is that you're using terms like cost-benefit to evaluate things. You're talking about aggregate impact. And in addition, you're talking about pilot projects. And I think the Portland Energy Efficient Home Pilot Project, which is a chance to perhaps convince some skeptics out there, both our affordable and for-profit developers, that actually increasing energy efficiency doesn't necessarily break the bank and that there are some techniques, is the way to really bring people, you know, into the fold. Now we know at government that we can always, as a default, drop the hammer and regulate. And we technically have that power. But what a refreshing thing to actually bring industry with us.
Yeah.
And do it in a way where people get to see the, you know, f- for themselves that these things maybe aren't as onerous as they thought. Use pilot projects rather than mandates. And so I think recommendation 11 that you put on the slide is particularly important. But I also want to just say that from the affordable housing side of the ledger, this common sense green building approaches you're talking about are hugely important. Because what you're talking about is reducing energy costs for low-income residents. And that's very important. You're talking about improving indoor air quality for children and other at-risk people in buildings. Well, that's a concern to everybody. And you're talking about reducing operating costs for nonprofit owners through the use of durable, sustainable solutions. So it's just an absolute win-win across the board. And again, sometimes the pushback we get is from people who, at a time of economic crisis, where costs really matter more than ever, are worried about imposing new costs and burdens. And I think your focus on cost-benefit, your insistence or your desire that we have an aggregate picture of how all these affect people, and your recommendation that we use pilots to bring people into the fold, to show them that we can actually enhance energy efficiency standards without breaking the bank, is hugely beneficial to this ongoing debate. So I want to thank my colleague, Commissioner Leonard, for his leadership on this, but I want to thank each of you for the time you've put into this, because I think you give us the promise of moving the ball, but doing so where we bring everyone together. And that for the long term, I think, is very beneficial.
One thing. Maybe you're hearing throughout the presentation actually what we're trying to say, which is right now is not the time for small ideas. Right now is not the time for contraction of how the community can be banded together to actually create something new. 30 years ago, we had a similar contraction, and we came out with the comprehensive plan. This is a huge opportunity, actually. And we are moving into a zone where people have to be brighter, have to be smarter, and have to listen. And we want to, as a body that represents the community, want to actually be the voice for that and move things forward. So I really thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Anyone signed up to testify on this?
No one signed up. Oh, no.
Okay. Please call the vote on 1508.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I also want to point out Ann Hill, before she escapes out of here, has been the dynamo behind a lot of our green stuff, the Bureau of Development Services, including overseeing our biodiesel program. So thank you, Ann. I want to acknowledge your great work on this. Aye.
Potter.
I really want to thank this group and Commissioner Leonard for your leadership on this. This is I'm not sure most folks would recognize how really big this is. But it's in addition to reducing our carbon footprint, it's a different way of doing business by the city with the community, particularly the development community. And I think this effort is spectacular. And it will have some long-term results. And the results, I believe, in addition to reducing our carbon footprint, are around how we solve problems in this city. And this is a problem-solving document on how you get together and utilize, even in a difficult time like this, the opportunities that are inherent within the current economic climate. So we really want to thank you folks for a tremendous job, a great presentation, and a wonderful document. I vote aye.
Thanks.
Please call the vote on 1509.
Fish?
The only other observation I'm going to make is that I wonder whether, given the positive work that's being done here, we should change the acronym. Something about DRAC that doesn't seem as welcoming and as I don't
it's
know.
Reflective
what,
of the darker sides of my
personality.
Yeah,
it has what's the word? It has a onomatopoeia. What's the
Dracula?
Whatever. But
the Dark Lord.
There you go.
The Dark Lord.
For all the reasons that the mayor stated and I stated before, I'm pleased to vote aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Going to move to the regular agenda. Did you have a recommendation on, could you please read 1532?
Authorize the Bureau of Housing and Community Development to contract for winter warming centers for families and the medically vulnerable and provide funding to support existing winter shelter.
Mayor, two of our colleagues are not present today. I would respectfully propose that we amend this so that it is not an emergency ordinance, but just a regular ordinance so that it's, we have a presentation today, but the matter be set over to the next meeting for a vote.
Second.
Second reading.
Call the vote on the amendment.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Mr. Fish.
Well, Mayor, I'm very pleased to co-sponsor this. Let me get my notes. This ordinance with Commissioner Leonard. City of Portland has a very ambitious 10-year plan to end homelessness. It is based on a model that says that if we provide someone with a decent place to live and services long-term, some of our most vulnerable people, including chronically homeless people, can have a chance to rebuild their lives. It is at the core of our housing strategy as a city, and this council has on a number of occasions reaffirmed that the 10-year plan is, in fact, our strategy. And as I learned when I was in Washington, D.C. recently at a national conference on homelessness, our 10-year plan is the envy of the country. And we really have a lot of progress which we can be proud of in terms of moving chronically homeless people off the street into housing. Recently, we conducted something called a vulnerability index survey, working with a nationally renowned group called Common Ground. And we actually, for the first time, did a survey of homeless adults living on the street. And with the consent of all the participants, which meant we got written consent, we took their photograph and we filled out a asked them to help us fill out a questionnaire. We used volunteers who were specially trained. And I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but approximately 600 people were surveyed. And we learned some very disturbing things. We learned that 47% of that, what the Common Ground people call cohort, but the sample, 47% are at enhanced risk of dying on the streets over the next 7 days, 7 years, excuse me. And the way they determine most vulnerable person, MVP status, is they look at the kinds of health conditions people have and they make some reasonable projections. One of the statistics that I thought caught us all by surprise was that when we compare Portland to other major cities where the Common Ground has conducted a similar survey, we have the highest percentage within the people surveyed of folks that have three or more life-threatening illnesses bundled together. That means that there are, within the most vulnerable group on the street, people that are, for example, have kidney failure, HIV, AIDS, and some other life-threatening disease. And I think since we were together yesterday, Mayor and Commissioner Leonard, at some very moving Veterans Day ceremonies, I think it's also important to observe that 22% of the most vulnerable group, so half are the most vulnerable, and of that 22%, slightly more than one in five, are veterans. And of those veterans, an alarming number said that they were not receiving services from the Veterans Administration, either were not aware of services, were not receiving services, or had been unable to obtain services. And when we spoke, when we presented the report to the community, it prompted me and others to observe that there are men and women who wore the uniform of this country who are at greater risk of dying on the street of the country they defended than in the battlefields in which they served, which I think we all acknowledge is a national disgrace. And as I said recently in an article that appeared in the newspaper where I was interviewed, I noted that Portland has a real opportunity here to demonstrate that as adults we recognize the difference between our own views about the war and the justness of any particular war and the deep moral commitment that we nonetheless have to people who served and have come back with the ravages of war and need to be reintegrated to our community. And I have great confidence that in Portland we can make that distinction, that we can have strong views about the war, and many of us are solidly against this war, but that we can have the highest regard and respect for the people who wore the uniform and have come back and have now suffered because of their service. So we're trying to move forward as a community, armed with the data that we have about our most vulnerable people on the streets. We are trying to keep faith with our 10-year plan to end homelessness, which is the best model that, in my opinion, has ever been devised for how to deal with chronic homelessness. But at the same time, we need to break a logjam in this community. And the logjam is about the role of shelters as a short-term solution to deal with people when there's no other option. Now, I'm not going to stand here or sit here as the housing commissioner and extol the great virtues of shelters. Shelters are an interim solution. We know what the long-term solution is. But as a caring and decent people, with an economy going in the toilet and more people, including families, on the streets, how can we not act to strengthen the social safety net to provide at least a warming center or a safe mat for people as an interim solution on the path to the self-sufficiency that we are all committed to, which is getting people a home with services? In partnering with Commissioner Leonard today, I think we are making a very profound statement to our community. The housing community is saying that we can be both for the 10-year plan, and we're fully committed to it, and at the same time, we recognize that we need to have some safety net for people on the foreseeable future until those units are built and people have long-term places to live. So I am pleased to join with my colleague to support this ordinance, which will take money that was sequestered from the last round of budget. This is not money that's being taken out of BHC, Bureau of Housing and Community Development's budget. This is not money being diverted from any current homeless program. This is money that's part of a surplus that was set aside as a reserve, which is to be tapped to open two warming centers. And the notion of warming centers is that during the bulk of the day, it's a place where people can go and escape the streets and find a collegial company, a meal, and a place to stay warm, literally. And it may very well save lives. And based on what we learned in the Vulnerability Index survey, it will save lives. The other feature of this that I want to call out before our presentation is that this is a partnership that extends to the county, Multnomah County. The warming center concept that we're presenting to council today has a contribution from the county, which recognizes its role, even during tough budget times. So I'm pleased to co-sponsor this ordinance with Commissioner Leonard, and I'd like to introduce Leora Berry from BHCD to lead us in a presentation on this proposal. Leora?
Hi. Well, good morning, Mayor Potter and commissioners. My name is Leora Berry. I work for the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and I want to speak in support of the $242,000 ordinance that is before you today. This would allow us to open the seasonal warming centers. And so what we learned in the past few years from the opening of the severe weather shelters, which are different because those only operate for maybe 10 or 20 evenings during the course of a season and only happen during very specific weather criteria, these seasonal warming centers would operate on a night-by-night basis from either 7 at night to 7 in the morning or 8 at night till 8 in the morning. And be functioning on a regular basis. The two sites would be, one would be for families, prioritized, but others would be able to also be able to access the site, and the other would be primarily for adults, including pregnant women, young youth who are maybe under 18 or around the 18 to 21 mark, as well as medically vulnerable adults and other adults out on the street. You referenced the medical vulnerability survey, and what we found, I think, that was very surprising was out of 302 vulnerable people, 91 reported that they had a history of exposure-related illnesses, frostbite, immersion foot, or hypothermia. And that's not something we typically think of here in the tepid weather of the Pacific Northwest, but we're very, very wet, and sometimes the coldness escapes those of us that are housed, but it's obviously affecting the health and well-being of people who are sleeping on our streets. So these funds would be leveraged by an additional $100,000 that the county has prioritized, which they unfortunately had to be able to attain through cuts to their existing services. But that's how committed they are, because they are ending up right now turning away families who are homeless on the streets, All of our sheltering services are operating at full capacity. We've improved most of our shelters and our services over the past few years. And this season, our winter shelter services are also greatly improved with on-site social services to help people move from the shelters into permanent housing. But still, there's a gap. So we know that the youth system shelter is also at capacity, and we needed to do something different this season to make sure that there were places for people to go inside to get warm and get away from the cold and wet season. So the county staff were here earlier today and had to leave. They weren't able to stay for the whole time, but they wanted to meet a state their appreciation for your hopeful support of this project and how deeply supportive they are of this, evidenced not just by their funding commitment, but also they are working with us to identify county-owned and operated buildings, of which we would have these two sites working at. We also have two providers tentatively identified that would provide the service, and so it's really a matter of making sure we have the funding and then moving forward and to hopefully open them within 30 days after we know what the final decision is. The other things we found in that medical vulnerability survey were things that were very shocking. We're going to continue to issue these surveys, and we have been continuing to receive them and enter the data. We have almost 700 individual health questions and information entered into the system right now, and that is a lot of people in a very short amount of time to have been completed a 45-question survey. Overall, we found over 30 people that have end-stage renal disease that are sleeping on our streets. We have 133-plus people with heart conditions. So we have people, obviously, with very, very serious health problems, and these warming centers will allow them, again, to come inside. And while it's not a full-service model and it doesn't provide daytime services and it's just a mat on the floor, it's still a place for people to come in and be safer. We also had a large percentage of people, I think it was over 45%, that reported that they had been a victim of a violent attack since sleeping on the streets. So again, this is real, just basic safety off the streets. This is also part of a larger winter shelter model that we have. This isn't the be-all and end-all of what we think needs to be provided or what we do provide. At the county and the city, we both operate and want to maintain the existing day shelter services operations. We've made recent improvements, as I said, to the adult winter shelter as well as the family winter shelters. We're going to expand the hours of operation of 211 info, which will allow evening and weekend access for people who are trying to find out where to go and how to get there and if there's room to be able to get that information. We also, the county and HAP will continue to provide special need vouchers for people that are severely in medical need or a family if they would otherwise not be able to have a space inside so that they can also get inside. These seasonal warming centers, which again, we're talking about just seasonal for this winter, and hopefully the economy will all be back on shape next year, but maybe not. And then the ability to further expand severe weather shelters with a more tight criteria than we've done in previous years. So we'll still begin looking at Red Cross as being our partner. So during the times when it's really, really cold or we have ice storms, we can still get even more people off the street and inside into warm conditions. So are there any questions?
Very good presentation. Thank you.
We have a Commander Benson over here, or if anybody has any questions to ask.
Good morning, Mayor, members of the council. My name is Dave Benson. I'm the commander of the Police Bureau's Tactical Operations. I was an original committee member leading to the 10-year plan to end homelessness, and I've been commander of Southeast and Central Precinct. So I'm somewhat versed on this issue. I applaud Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Leonard for bringing this forward, and Leora, because this is critically important for our community. It's a very practical matter. All the vulnerable people we can get off the streets reduces victimization, reduces the amount of time the police bureau has to be involved with these people, either assisting them as victims of crimes or in some minority of cases. Some of these folks get pretty desperate being out in the street and they commit crimes, and we have to introduce them or reintroduce them to the criminal justice system, and quite frankly, that is not the best place for them. So, again, I applaud this, and I think it is, although a very temporary measure, a Band-Aid approach, and the long range is certainly permanent housing, I think it's an important step. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Did anybody sign up to testify on this issue?
No one signed up.
Okay.
So I recognize that we're going to have to set this over for a vote on a second hearing, so I'd like to say a couple things.
Okay.
Because Commissioner Fish was exactly right, this is really a significant change in how we've approached folks that have been put in a place in life where they have literally no place to go and no place to sleep, and oftentimes, honestly, through no fault of their own, due to mental illnesses and oftentimes because of choices they made due to drug addiction and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And since I've been here, there has been a tension between the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which I do support, and this effort that really was spearheaded by the Police Bureau to find places for people to be at night rather than vulnerable out in the street. And I would be really remiss if I didn't acknowledge the work of Sergeant Matt Ingen, who's sitting in the audience, Bill Sennett, and I don't see our guy Jeff Meyer out here, but certainly nobody who understands or has been involved in this issue cannot acknowledge Jeff's focus on trying to address people that have been left out in the street, who then become victims of crime oftentimes. And, one of my regrets is that I don't get to work with these guys closer. They're not just good police officers. These are stellar human beings who easily could come to work and put in their 8 hours or 10 hours and go home and call it a day and be good cops. But that's not what they do. They have, and I've in some ways find myself identifying a lot with them in their effort on this issue. And I think they have been received oftentimes, as I'm received, rather brusque and uncaring about folks in the bureaucracy, but what that hides is a real understanding of the finality of human life and the cruelty that life can bring to the most vulnerable people, and it sometimes manifests itself in our behaviors as being brusque or uncaring about how people feel, but it's really in an effort to try to protect the most vulnerable, and you become somewhat impatient when you can't get there as quickly as you realize people need that help. So that we're here at this point today is of a tremendous, I think, achievement by Commissioner Fish. This is not something that, notwithstanding my desires, came about until Commissioner Fish joined the council. And I certainly need to acknowledge and say how much not only I appreciate it, but on behalf of all the people whose lives I believe this is not only saving, and that's obviously significant, but another more important thing is it brings dignity to people who who may not be health-wise threatened with losing their life by sleeping under a bridge, but we deserve, they deserve better. They deserve our efforts, of which you have brought our focus on by bringing this resolution today. To me, this is really a significant day that won't get a lot of attention because the people we're helping are often the people others in our community try to avoid looking at or talking to or certainly being talked to by them. And without the effort of these guys from the Police Bureau, we wouldn't be here today. So I would encourage everybody to try to embrace the cops that come in to talk to you as trying to help people, even though sometimes it may come across as a little pushy. It's really more of an effort to try to help the very same people BHCD wants to help, and that you're here today with them joining in this effort means a lot to me. And you've earned some credits with me and that you can cash in at your will in the future by being so thoughtful and creative today. And I want to recognize it and appreciate it very much.
Commissioner Leonard, thank you for those remarks, and I want to associate myself with them. I also want to, in addition to the people you singled out, I'd like to thank Leora Berry and Sally Erickson, who are the two very talented full-time staff people at the Bureau of Housing and Community Development who are working on homelessness issues, Mary Lee, our colleague at the county, Commissioner Wheeler, who has shown an interest in this, Commissioner Leonard, you, our friends at the Police Bureau. But I also want to just close by noting that on election night, our president-elect, in his marvelous speech, summoned what he called a new spirit of patriotism in our country. And he defined patriotism as a renewed spirit of caring for each other and for redoubling our efforts to help our neighbors. And this council, during this economic downturn, has been very clear in wanting us to step up and be much more bold in how we deal with the crisis that we find in housing. And we will be moving shortly on a resource access center and seeking council approval so we can, you know, start building that in August of next year. We're working with the Veterans Administration to try to fix some problems with VASH vouchers and that veterans particularly are finding. We're working with Portland Development Commission to try to move a development in South Waterfront, which would address the specific needs of veterans. We have an ambitious foreclosure relief package that we are working on. I could go on and on and on, but the message I want the public to hear is that this council is very engaged in dealing with this emergency. And today is in presenting for consideration a warming center proposal, we are offering a bridge which will be a gap, excuse me, a bridge that will gap, provide a gap.
Boy, I'm we know what you mean.
Somewhere there is a sentence.
Is there someone who can help me translate this into English?
You're going to fill the gap.
We will fill a gap. Thank you. And our long-term vision, as everyone has mentioned, is to honor and to fund the 10-year plan. But this will provide a necessary safety net for our most vulnerable people. And I thank you for your presentations and your good work, and we'll be voting on this next week. Thank you, Mayor.
Yes, and thank you folks very much. I think this is a much more practical and humane way to solve a problem that was very obvious to a lot of people, but I really appreciate your leadership on that issue, Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Leonard. Thank you, folks. Goes to a second reading next Wednesday. Okay. Please read item 1533.
Declare November 12th, 2008 to be a day of recognition for Mulugeta Surah Proclamation.
I'd like to call up Maria Lisa Johnson, Randy Blazik. Is Emily Gottfried or Norm Costa here? Good. We're here today to honor the life of Mulugeta Surah, who is an Ethiopian citizen and attended Portland Community College here in Portland. 20 years ago today, he was brutally murdered by some skinheads. And since then, his death has had a tremendous impact on the city of Portland. Hundreds of community members have held vigils to honor Mulugeta Surah and also defend our city from the senseless violence that led to his death. So I want to read a proclamation to the memory of Mulugeta Surah and to his son, who is now a pilot in Ethiopia. I also want to dedicate this proclamation to the many community members who worked tirelessly to make our city a more inclusive and welcoming place. And after I read the proclamation, then I'll turn it over to Maria Lisa Johnson and the members of the Coalition Against Hate Crimes. Whereas the late Mulugeta Surah, an Ethiopian national and student at Portland Community College, was murdered in a brutal hate crime the night of November 12, 1988, in southeast Portland. 20 years following Mulugeta Surah's murder, the city of Portland has proudly become a city that treasures the rich diversity of its residents, including immigrants, sexual minorities, religious and ethnic groups, who are essential to building a vibrant community. Whereas the city code states that the city of Portland is committed to improving the lives of all of its residents and strives to eliminate all forms of discrimination because such discrimination poses a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of the residents of Portland. Whereas on January 16, 2008, Portland City Council adopted an ordinance creating the Office of Human Relations, and on September 17, 2008, Council appointed a Human Rights Commission, both of which are working to eliminate